This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. Hope you're enjoying your 4th of July this year. 4th of July is synonymous with baseball. Maybe you're listening to us at your favorite softball game that happens on the 4th of July each year. And if you've watched a Major League Baseball game lately, you have probably seen bats breaking. And I'm not talking about bats breaking like in the old days when they would merely crack and sort of fall apart. Today, it's like an explosion. You have shards of flying, pointed spears, dangerous projectiles that draw blood from players and wound fans in the stands. Many baseball players and observers lay the blame on the growing popularity of bats made from maple. They all used to be made from ash. Major League Baseball says it is looking into the problem. Its Safety and Health Advisory Committee met last week to talk about whether maple bats should be benched. We'll be talking this hour about how wooden bats are made, why do maple bats splinter, what's the difference between maple and ash, how do things like tree rings and grain direction affect the bat's performance at the plate. And if you'd like to talk about baseball bats, science of baseball bats, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And of course, if you're in Second Life, you can go to our Science Friday Island and join some avatars there and ask questions from us in Second Life. Let me introduce my guests. Brian Bultz is the general manager, Larimer & Norton Incorporated. That's the timber division of Hillerick & Bradsby, the maker of Louisville Slugger bats. He joins us by phone from Warren County, Pennsylvania. Welcome to Science Friday on the 4th. Thank you for being with us today.
Yes, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Lloyd Smith is a professor of mechanical and materials engineering at Washington State University. He joins us from Moscow, Idaho. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Happy to be on your show.
Let's talk about the history, Lloyd, about the history of maple bats. When did they first start entering the world of baseball?
Maple came in at around the late 90s. 97, I think, is probably when they first started becoming dominant. At the time, there really was just, I guess, not much interest in maple. Ash seemed to be working well as a wood, but there were some people experimenting with different types of wood, and the one that, I guess, took off the best was made by the company Sam Bat, Sam Holgreen, and once his bat got into the major leagues and Barry Bonds began using his bat and got the home run record that year. The maple bats really took off.
Mm-hmm. Brian Bultz, is that the major number? Most bats that you make at Louisville Slugger are maple now?
For the major leagues, we are now over 50% of our production is maple. In the other areas, amateur ranks, it's still not near. It may be only about 15 to 20%.
What is the difference in the wood between maple and the old ash? Let me ask you, Brian, first. What's the advantage there?
Well, maple, the surface of maple is a little bit harder. Our research shows that you really can't hit the ball any further with a maple bat than you can with an ash bat. But I think what players like about the maple bat is that they can take that out into batting practice. And they can put 100 swings on that, and then the surface of the wood will stay nice and hard, and they can then use that in the game. Where with ash, maybe over 100, 200 hits in batting practice, you might see the surface start to flake a little bit, and the growth between the grains start to shear off a little bit. So a lot of players like that feature with the maple bat as opposed to ash.
Because I guess we were all under the impression that you can hit the ball farther with maple, and you're saying that's not true.
There is no scientific evidence that shows that the maple bat hits it farther, no.
Lloyd, you agree?
That's true. When you look at the performance of bats and everything being equal and all you're doing is changing the wood species itself, there's really no difference in performance at all. There could be one slight performance advantage with maple, and it's somewhat counterintuitive, but maple tends to be a little heavier than ash, which not all people like. But it turns out that when you're trying to determine how far a ball can be hit, having a heavier bat can be a slight advantage. But that's going to be fairly small, and there's also a disadvantage if you're just trying to make contact with the ball. So While it could allow you to hit the ball a little further, it may also make it more difficult for you to be able to hit the ball at all.
Mm. Why do maple bats splinter and ash just crack?
There's a variety of reasons, and I don't know that there's just one. First of all, because maple is slightly heavier, when you make a maple bat, you're looking for wood that's going to be lighter weight, and the strength of the wood is proportional to its weight. So when you select a lighter wood, then you also get a wood of lower strength. Then people will also do things to the geometry of the wood. If you make the handle or the taper region of the bat slightly smaller in diameter, you can save weight there as well. That also weakens the bat. Another thing people will do is they will dry the wood out, and some of these aggressive drying processes can actually result in a permanent weight loss in the bat, but that tends to make the bat more brittle or lower its toughness.
Brian, your reasons? Brian, are you there?
Yes.
Why do we think Lloyd said possibly that we have thinner handles on the bats and that there's different moisture content in the maple that causes as two reasons why they splinter more than ash.
And it's the structure of the grains too. It's a closed grain wood as opposed to an open grain wood. You can see the grains on an ash bat a lot clearer when you're grading that piece of wood than you can on a maple bat. But I agree with what he said about the moisture content, and we have always attempted to keep our moisture not anywhere below any 8% or something like that. We've also tried to keep our drying process where we have a longer drying process at a lower temperature to try not to pull the moisture out of the wood really quickly. So we've done some things to try to help with the strength of the wood for maple.
Mm-hmm. Grain orientation is important. And the thing that makes maple a good wood for durability as far as the flaking of the barrel region is concerned also makes it problematic for the strength of the bat in bending, because you it's difficult to identify the grain direction in maple, at least in comparison to ash. It's also difficult to show that those grains are aligned with the length of the bat, which increases its strength.
Because we have, speaking about that, we have heard people comment on this, saying that an ash bat will bend a little bit more when it's stressed, when it hits the ball, whereas an ash bat doesn't, so it has to break. Is there any truth to that? A maple bat will resist the bending.
Right. From my perspective, the primary truth to that would be in the grain orientation, that if you have and what we have to recognize, we're talking about natural materials, so you can't always guarantee that every bat is going to have the same type of grain or grain orientation. But to the extent that maple is more difficult to identify grain orientation, you're more likely to have a bat with poorly oriented grain, and when that grain is not oriented parallel to the length of the bat, it's more likely to break in a brittle fashion.
Mm-hmm. We talked to a scientist who was on a former Major League Baseball committee a few years ago when they first started looking into this problem, and he said that the recommendation from that committee was to make the handles thicker, and that would solve the problem. We had thicker handles. We know that Major League players coming up through the ranks want thinner and thinner handles. If we make them thicker, would that solve it, Brian?
That would go some of the way, yes. I think you would see less of it. I don't think it would eliminate it completely. But the handles in baseball these days are I think they're all under an inch in diameter. The other thing you could do would be to maybe not have the barrel be as large as some of these are. Limit it to maybe 2.5 inches in diameter rather than 2 5/8. That would help as well. But I think the moisture content, keeping it, not letting that moisture go below 8%, would also be a factor in helping out the that bat from breaking as often as it does. But there's really nothing you can do to keep it eliminated completely. I mean, you're still going to have that breakage in maple and in ash, just the way, because it's a piece of wood.
Well, and keep in mind that this problem is perhaps more significant with the introduction of maple bats, but injuries of this type did occur when ash bats dominated the market. So when you talk about doing things like increasing moisture content or increasing your handle diameter, that may contribute to diminishing the injury rate, but it's not as if you're making it safe or unsafe.
I guess, but when we see these bats breaking like spears, some of the times they're pointing into the turf. You know, they're stuck in there. I don't remember ever seeing those in the old ash bat days. They look much more dangerous when they're flying through the air.
Well, part of that is because with the introduction of the maple bats, you've got a greater proportion of bats failing. So you have a larger sample to select from or to observe.
You agree with that, Brian?
I would agree with that, yes. I mean, when you have as much maples as in the Major League Baseball right now, you're going to see it a lot more than what it was even 3 and 4 years ago when maple was maybe only 20 or 25%.
So I remember there was I remember in spring training, there was a baseball player standing on third base who got 18 stitches from a bat that hit him in the arm. And I don't remember ever seeing that. I've only been watching baseball 50 years, so I haven't seen everything.
Well, and again, keep in mind that you've got many, many things coming together, and it's not just that maple is brittle, but you've got the grain orientation, you've got the weight issue. Mm-hmm. There's a number of things that are coming together to cause the problem and produce this greater number of bat failures that we're having than we've seen in the past.
Now, Major League Baseball is looking into this. We're gonna go to the break, but I want to come back and talk later on a little bit about what you think the recommendations might be to Major League Baseball as they study this. What to do about this breakage rate and the problem with maple bats. So stay with us. We're going to take a break. We'll come back with Brian Bolts and Lloyd Smith after this break. Take your questions, 1-800-989-8255. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatto, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. We're talking about the Major League Baseball and baseball bats, the physics of baseball bats this hour. And while Major League Baseball is debating the future of maple bats, a tiny bug, the emerald ash borer, is threatening the future of ash bats. Now, this beetle kills ash trees, and it's invading Pennsylvania, and that's important because that's where most of the ash for our baseball bats come from. Here to talk to us about what we can do about the insect invasion is Sven-Erik Spiesschuger. He's an entomologist for the Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture, and he's tracking the emerald ash borer's movement in Pennsylvania. He joins us by phone from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And if you want to see a little bit of the problem, you can go to iTunes and download a Science Friday podcast, video podcast about this problem. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Nice to talk with you.
How big a problem is this borer?
Well, in other states where it's already been for a few years, it's been a devastating problem, wiping out close to 30 million trees already.
Wow. And when did it first arrive in the U.S.?
Well, it was first discovered in 2002, but doing some tree ring analysis, they're fairly certain it was here in the mid-90s.
Mid-90s. And how do you get rid of it?
Unfortunately, right now, we don't have a way to get rid of it, as you say. The national program, which is set up by the USDA, right now is targeting release of parasitoids, but we're many years away from that right now.
And Mr. Spiesschuger, how dangerous is this? Give us an idea of what kind of damage this could do to a forest once the beetle gets there.
Well, to put it in perspective, you could compare this to American chestnut blight. And for those who are familiar with that, we used to have quite a few chestnut trees in our woods, and there are now almost none, and those that do grow die within a few years. And that's pretty much what we're looking at right now.
Wow. That wiped out lots of trees.
Yeah. In Pennsylvania, we have approximately 3-5% ash component in our woodlands. And in the areas where we have our baseball bat factories, the percentage is a little higher, and the quality of the timber is a lot better. Now, mm-hmm. unfortunately, we've recently detected the beetle in Mercer County, which is in western Pennsylvania, along Interstate 80, and that's getting just a little too close for comfort, unfortunately.
It's actually right on the highway.
That is right on the highway, yes.
And that's not a good thing.
No, that's not a good thing. Unfortunately, we believe this beetle, other than spreading by just flying naturally, can be moved around a lot faster when people transport firewood or nursery stock or basically improperly processed timber. And basically, we attribute man-assisted movement to it spreading a lot faster than it needed to in the Michigan, Ohio, and other states and parts of southern Canada as well.
Dr. Spiessugar, is there a best-case scenario here?
Best-case scenario is basically we continue to do programs like we're doing today. We get the word out. People curtail their activities, such as taking firewood camping, and buy it when they get there, and we can slow the movement in time for perhaps a natural parasite or predator to take hold and help keep this in check. Unfortunately for Pennsylvania and our bat factory areas, it doesn't look like we're going to be able to catch up in time, unfortunately.
So it's going to get to the bat forests?
I think it is.
Wow. And that will be the ash bats?
That's pretty much it. Now, of course, we can get ash from other sources, but in Pennsylvania, we'd prefer to have them from here, of course.
Thank you for taking time to be with us, Dr. Spiessugar, and have a happy 4th of July.
Oh, you too.
Sven Erik Spiessugar talking to us about this bat forest problem. It's going to turn into a forest problem because this is where this beetle is headed toward the bats. Joining us now to talk more about this, our folks who are still with us, Brian Boltz of the Hillerick and Bradsby, maker of Louisville Slugger Bats, and Lloyd Smith of Washington State University. Brian, are you bat folks worried about this beetle?
Yes, we've been concentrating on this for 2 to 3 years now, even before it was even in the state of Pennsylvania, and have been in contact with the USDA and state agencies and just trying to track it and understand what we need to do when it does get into our area, because it will, you know, we will be quarantined and so that we are prepared to be able to you know, get our wood down to our Louisville factory when it's needed.
Brian Boltz, what makes Pennsylvania ash so special for the bats?
Well, you can get ash from, you know, in New England states, you can get it down south, but the Pennsylvania ash just has that right mixture of flexibility, hardness, density, that makes it a good bat. Our company purchased these sawmills in Pennsylvania back in the mid-50s and has really brought in all their ash from that area ever since, and it just turns out to be the best type of ash for baseball bats.
What is there about where the trees grow, the tree's home, that affects the composition of the wood?
I think it's just a mixture of the soil and the terrain. We are in a very mountainous area here in northern Pennsylvania and southern New York that allows for better growing. You get bigger trees, and obviously you need a lot of good growth, wide growth, because the player wants to see the growth rings, and they want to see them to be even growth, and they want width between the growth rings. And we just found that this area of the country is the best for that.
1-800-989-8255, talking about the physics of baseball bats this 4th of July. Let's go to Ann in Minneapolis. Hi, Ann.
Hey, guys. I was wondering, I'm on my way to my baseball game right now. When I get the game-used bats, both maple and ash, they're shaved down, the maple more so than the ash, so that the barrel is huge, but it snaps right at the handle.
And so you're wondering whether the shaving does something extra to make
it. Yeah, because they don't shave the ash in the same way they shave the maples.
Interesting. Brian Lloyd, any comments?
Well, they're doing that to save weight on the bat. So you're doing that to have a lighter bat so it's easier to swing, but the cost is going to be that the bat's going to tend to break easier when you hit it with the ball.
Yeah, I would just comment that, you know, if it's being shaved down, it must be being shaved down by the player, because if a player orders a specific model and that calls for a diameter of the handle to be 15/16, then that's what the bat will go out as. If there's the same model on the bat and the handle of the maple looks smaller, it would be shaved down by the player itself.
And how come you're not using metal bats?
Well, you don't use metal bats because that's not baseball. That's like college ball.
And you're playing softball?
No, baseball.
You're playing baseball. I thought everybody was using metal bats these days, and even anywhere but the major leagues.
No, a lot of teams are using the maple and the ash bats now because they have a better feel when you're playing the game, and they don't vibrate in your hands the way that the metal bats do.
What team are you on?
Well, I'm not going to broadcast that.
You don't want to shout out to your team? Okay.
No, because they don't know that I'm a Minnesota Public Radio listener.
Okay. Thank you, Ann. Have a good holiday, and good luck with your game.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 1-800-989-8255. Michael in Lenox, Kansas. Hi, Michael. Is it Lenexa?
It's Lenexa. How are you doing?
Hi, how are you? Happy 4th.
Thank you. I had a question for you. The settlers used to make their wagon wheel hubs out of elm because elm doesn't split.
Why not make a baseball bat out of elm?
I imagine you can't get much elm, but if you could, would that work? Have we tried it?
Brian Lloyd?
There's not much elm in this area of the country. We don't see it hardly at all in the forests up here. So we haven't really tried it. There's really not enough supply of it to for all the baseball bats that would need to be made.
I'm just scanning over the properties of elm. Elm turns out to be a fairly lightweight wood, but the strength is not quite that of your ash. So you may find that you'd have a failure problem for the impact that a bat has.
What are cricket bats made out of?
Cricket bats are made out of willow, an English willow.
Would that be something we'd look into?
Well, there you have a very different mechanism. Cricket bats, it is a very lightweight wood, but the structure of the bat is very different, and because of its geometry, it's allowed to hold up. Now, there's also something else about the cricket bat. The handle is made of cane, so the blade and the handle are of two different materials. And that's something that Major League Baseball has never allowed. It's always had to be one solid wood bat.
What do you think the recommendations of the committee that's meeting now might be? What are they going to come back with, possibly making thicker handles? That seemed to be the easiest thing to suggest, would it not?
Well, so increasing the handle diameter would be one thing. Now, that's a very dramatic suggestion, because so far the geometry has been the one thing the players could work with, but I would say there's other things that Major League Baseball could do that they haven't done the concern is that if you mess around with the design of the bat, that you're somehow going to be changing the performance of the bat. And we've been able to show that if your bat is solid wood, the performance really is not going to change much by your species. So you could do different things. You could laminate your bat, kind of like the way plywood is made, and that could increase the strength. You could reinforce the bat. You could put a composite on the outside of the bat. In fact, some people sell bats like that to minor league teams, and they significantly increase the durability of the bat. And then when the bat does break, it's even safer than an ash bat, because that reinforcement is able to keep the bat together after it cracks.
Aren't you going to have this statistics problem then? You know, baseball lives by statistics. Don't you have to put an asterisk of the era of the new baseball bat or something?
Well, that's certainly the concern of why they haven't gone to other kinds of bats. But we've been able to test these bats in the laboratory under very strict conditions. And shown that there really is no difference in performance. The issue is what's going on in the barrel of the bat. And as long as that barrel is solid wood, whether that is laminated or reinforced in the handle or a thick or a skinny handle, those things really don't affect the performance of the bat.
Brian, you want to check in on this?
I really would highly doubt that Major League Baseball would get into something of a laminate or a composite. They're really into the history of the game, and it's always been a one solid piece of wood. And I would think if they're going to stay with the maple bat, and again, this is not only a management issue, it's a union issue. This has to be bargained to change any of the either the specifications of the bat or the species of the wood. I would think they're going to go to some kind of change in the specifications to limit the amount of times that these bats break, as opposed to banning the species altogether.
There could be one other thing that the Major League Baseball would do. I think the most realistic thing would be increasing the handle diameter, but they could require that particular wood species or wood profiles be approved, and that they be given some type of testing protocol to show how they would break and then determine whether that mode of failure would be safe in play.
We're talking about the physics of baseball bats this hour, Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. So when you say statistics, does that mean the diameter of the bat handle? When you use the specifications, I mean, is that what you're getting at?
That would be one thing. But even so, you might take, or if you were to put this through a testing protocol, one thing would be the geometry. What is the diameter of the handle or the shape of the taper? But you might have some actual physical test. It might be players on the field. It might be put in a machine. We have performance machines that measure the performance of bats, and there are similar machines that look at the durability of bats, so that they're impacted in a controlled environment. So if they break, people aren't hurt, and you could then study the way they break and whether that's safe in a game.
Well, we ran out of time, but I want to just have the take home. One of the take home messages that I've learned today is that maple does not work. I mean, it's no better a wood in a baseball bat than ash for hitting a baseball. It's all about, if I hear you correctly, the durability of the bat.
That's right.
Yes, correct.
Wow. So much, and baseball players are so superstitious, you'll never convince them of anything else but that. Gentlemen, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today on the 4th of July.
My pleasure.
You're welcome. Brian Boltz is the general manager of Larimer & Norton Incorporated. That is the timber division of Hillerit & Bradsby, the maker of the Louisville Slugger Bats. Lloyd Smith is professor of mechanical and materials engineering at Washington State University. Now, what if I told you that my new business plan, I've got a new business, and this is how it's going to work. I want to sell you something that most people can already get for free or almost free, and you're going to pay a lot more money for it, and my product costs lots more. But the quality is about the same as the less expensive stuff or almost free stuff that you're getting now. And by the way, the cheap stuff is already being delivered straight to your home. You don't even have to transport it anywhere. You probably think I'm a bit nuts to go into business, right? Well, how did bottled water business become an $11 billion industry in this country? And bottling something that comes right to your tap already. That's what we'll be talking about for the rest of the hour. Plus, you've heard of a carbon footprint, but what about a water footprint? My next guest says that it takes about 53 gallons of water to make a simple single cup of coffee. About 530 gallons go into a cotton T-shirt. Where does this water come from? And are we going to use it all up? 53 gallons of water make a single cup of coffee. Here to tell us more is Elizabeth Royd, a freelance environmental writer based in Brooklyn and the author of the new book, Bottle Mania, How Water Went on Sale and Why We Bought It. She joins us from Rhinebeck, New York. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much.
When did bottled water take off here in the States?
You can pretty easily date it to 1977 when Perrier was introduced to urban areas, and it was a real niche product. It was really popular with urban professionals. People weren't walking down the street swigging from green glass bottles, but it started to change in 1989 with a sort of unspectacular technological innovation. Bottlers could put water into very lightweight, cheap, clear, very crystal clear plastic called PET plastic. And that's when the market really started to take off. The water was much cheaper. And then the next big moment in the history of bottled water was in the 90s when Coke and Pepsi got into the business. They were taking criticism for pushing sugary, fattening drinks on us. We have an obesity epidemic, and they each made their own bottled water.
All right. Elizabeth, hang on, because we have to take a break.
We'll come back.
It's okay. That's what I'm here for.
Okay.
We'll come back with Elizabeth right after this break and your questions. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatto, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. We're talking with Elizabeth Reut. She is the author of Bottle Mania, How Water Went on Sale and Why We Bought It. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Elizabeth, why did we buy something that comes out of our tap and we can get for next to nothing?
Well, we're pretty susceptible to marketing. Hundreds of millions of dollars were spent telling us that the water they were selling was pure and healthful and clean and crisp, and it sounded really good. And there wasn't much competition from tap water. Utilities don't have marketing budgets, and they're not telling you drink more tap water. It'll help you do your yoga poses. So it was pretty much it had all of our attention, and we bought up those messages. It was also, you know, it was fashionable. There were water. They gave us the idea that water signified that it was classy to drink this water, and the messages gradually morphed from fashion to fear as they played on ideas that perhaps tap water wasn't always so great.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've heard statistics thrown around that say that 60% of all the bottled water really starts out at the tap.
I've heard the number in the 40-something percent, and what that's referring to is Coke's water, Dasani, and Pepsi's water, Aquafina, the number one and number two best-selling brands. And they do start from municipal supplies, but it isn't just tap water, because they take the water and they run it through microfilters and reverse osmosis and expose it to ultraviolet light and ozonation. So, and then they put it into little plastic bottles. So it isn't going back out into the distribution system through pipes that may or may not be whatever.
Yeah. You also talked about the importance of the bottle. You said earlier that it wasn't until they came up with a new kind of bottle that it took off. What was that all about?
Oh, that was, well, it was like Evian, when that was first introduced to this country, it was in a PVC bottle. It cost the bottlers more, and it was a little bit cloudy and a little bit heavier. But the PET bottle, made from polyethylene terephthalate, is very lightweight and cheap and clear, and it makes the water look good. So that was a big change, and it made it possible for more people to get into the business and ship water over here.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Poland Springs, because the commercial says it comes from springs in Maine.
It does.
Give us the life cycle of a glass of Poland Spring water.
Okay. There are 8 or 9 different sources in Maine that supply Poland Spring, a company with a long history. Poland Spring started in 1845, but it was bought by Nestle in the 90s. And now they keep going to new towns to find new sources of water because the market is growing so quickly. So they drill a borehole near a spring. They don't actually collect the water where it's bubbling up out of the ground. There is an exemption from the FDA that says that you can call it spring water if you collect it nearby, and there's a hydrological connection with the actual spring. So they pump the water out of the ground. It goes into a tanker truck, a big, long silver truck, which makes its way to one of 2 bottling plants in Maine. And then they put it into the little bottles and send those little bottles off to distribution centers in New England and New York and a little bit farther. But it is a regional brand. It's a large regional brand. It's their best-selling brand, that and Arrowhead. They also own Deer Park and Ice Mountain and Ozarka and Zephyr Hills. Mm-hmm. So they are the largest bottled water company in the country.
Do people who live in those communities worry that they're going to lose their own natural supply of water?
Some of them do, and some of them don't. And I focused on a town where there's been a lot of people saying they don't want it, and they're worried about their wells, they're worried about the surrounding ecosystem, and there have been fights in other towns. There are water wars, really. People very, very angry, marching around, writing scathing letters to editors, really fighting this company, going to court over it, losing their life savings. But that said, there are people who also welcome the jobs, and they see it as a clean industry. So there's 2 sides to it, as usual.
We have a question from Second Life from Prospero Linden, who writes, "One question I have about those 53 gallons of water that go into the single cup of coffee is, how much of that water is really lost? How much is recycled into the system?"
Well, my book is about bottled water. Not someone else wrote a book about coffee water, Prince. But yes, with agriculture, a lot of it goes back down into this, into the aquifer or into the same watershed. And then I guess they call the water that moves around when it's exported in the coffee beans virtual water or embodied water. So water ends up in other places embodied by the product, whether it's a hamburger or a T-shirt or coffee. But yes, with agriculture, a lot of it does stay in the same watershed.
Another question from Bao Ur in Second Life is Fiji actually entirely water from Fiji?
Entirely, yes.
So it's trucked, shipped all the way over from the other side of the world?
First shipped, then trucked, yes. 5,000 miles in the ship and then distributed through the country on trucks.
That takes a lot of oil, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, and that's why Fiji, as I say in the book, has become the poster child for the carbon footprint of bottled water. And the company has listened to this complaint and has not only gone carbon neutral, but now claims to be carbon negative, buying offsets and things. But they are still sending the water away from Fiji to places all around the world.
Now, you write in your book that when you first started looking into bottled water, you thought that, gee, you would come away saying, oh, we can get the same water out of a tap. But now you've sort of changed your mind a bit.
Yeah, I went into it thinking that it was pretty simple, black and white. And the more I learned, the more I realized it's complicated. And I'm lucky to live in New York and have really great water. But other people aren't so lucky. In fact, 89.3 of the community water systems in this country do meet or exceed federal standards, but that still leaves millions of people, actually 29 million people, drinking water that doesn't make the grade. And so I found out what utilities do to clean up their water, and some do it more successfully than others, but you can see why many people are skeptical of their tap water. And to them, I say, find out what exactly is going on in your water and then get a good filter to deal with it.
What is a good filter?
A good filter is like a reverse osmosis filter, which takes out nearly everything. It takes out all the, you know, these industrial contaminants, agricultural contaminants, perchlorate, rocket fuel. But they're expensive up front, although you'll save money in the long run buying this filter and maintaining it than over buying bottled water for the rest of your life. So, you know, there is a cost to the filter. They waste a bit of water. They force the water through a membrane, and there's rejected water in a sort of brine of all these contaminants that goes down your drain. So there's, you know, trade-offs with everything.
What about these big blocks of carbon for the under-sink filters? That's not enough, you're saying.
It's enough. It depends what your issue is. That's a cheaper filter, easier to maintain, doesn't waste as much water. So I would go to that first if depending on the contaminants. But if there were things that you were that couldn't deal with, go to the RO. I have some links on my website that tell you how to evaluate what kind of filter to get and what they do. And the website is simple. It's just bottlemania.net. And then go to the links page, and you'll find all these great sources to guide you through it.
Well, we're talking with the author of Bottle Mania, Elizabeth Reut. Then you can go to her website, and if you forget, you can go to Science Friday, and we'll send you to that website. So you had your mind changed a little bit about the whole idea about how water is handled and used and where it comes from, where it goes.
Yeah, I learned that bottled water in itself isn't the worst thing in the world. I mean, after I looked at it, and I looked at this carbon footprint, I looked at the plastics issue, the waste, the litter, the privatization, I mean, the huge issue of whether companies can come in and take water away and make money off of it. So it isn't the worst thing in the world, but, you know, it's better to buy water than to buy a soda, of course. But the big message in the book is that if our political leaders continue to underfund and ignore the nation's water infrastructure, and the public continues to flee municipal supplies for private, these systems are going to degrade to the point where only people who can afford to buy good water are going to have it. And that would be a real tragedy. So the book is really about protecting and improving municipal supplies.
Hi, Eddie in Tallahassee. You're next on Science Friday. Welcome.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi there.
I was just wondering if these big companies are doing anything to sort of get away from the production of these PET plastics, because, I mean, where are all these empty bottles going in the first place? I mean, aren't they sitting in the landfill for thousands of years?
They're not sitting for thousands of years yet because it's not that old, but there have been projections that they'll last that long. They like PET because it's light and cheap and it does the job, and they've responded to all this criticism by lightweighting the bottles, using fewer grams of plastic in them. The bottles are completely recyclable, or I should say downcyclable. They're not being made into new water bottles. When they're collected for recycling, they're downcycled into things like carpeting or sleeping bag filling or fleece jackets, things that are, of course, going to be used once and then go to a landfill. But the bigger problem is that only about 15% of these bottles make it back into recycling systems. People aren't hanging onto the bottles till they find a blue bin. People drink water on the go, and they're throwing the bottles out. And so they're turning into litter, floating into waterways and oceans, or getting buried in dumps or burned in incinerators.
Caroline in Anchorage. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much. I'm just wondering a couple of things. Number one, is this going to make it easier for multinationals to control water supplies? For instance, in India, where people have to queue up to buy water with their empty Coke bottles or whatever. And then the other question has to do with the dichotomy between people being environmentally sensitive and slugging down this. It sounds like we're being hosed by the hype, and I don't understand why people can't see the damage that they're doing and regulate all areas of their life.
First things first, multinationals, India. I write a bit about that in my book. Coke controls a lot of water in India. People are very angry. There's a lot of people devoted to getting rid of Coke in India. And people who... poor people who end up paying more for water all around the world, and as the municipal water supplies decline, rich people are buying water. They don't have a problem buying bottled water, but it's poor people who end up going far, spending hours and spending more money filling up those containers. I don't talk a lot about that in my book because so many other authors have covered this, the global water situation. I write about privatization here in the U.S. as it pertains to the bottled water issue. And the question about people being environmentally sensitive, how can they do this? I think people just don't understand. We forget that plastic comes from oil. We don't think about where anything goes after it leaves us, whether it's waste or wastewater. So I just hope that as people become educated about the environmental and social toll of the bottles and tap water, because everything has an impact, that they'll make an informed decision. But that said, some people are drinking it because they really don't like their tap water or it contains unhealthy ingredients. So there are lots of reasons people do it.
Talking with Elizabeth Royt, author of Bottle Mania on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. So you're saying that first test your water to see if it's okay, then you might not need to get any bottled water.
Yeah.
And then if it's not okay, you might want to invest in a high-quality water filter.
Right. A good place to start is with your Right to Know report or Consumer Confidence report. If you are on a community water system, the utility is required to send you a report each year. And if you recycled it and don't know where it is, or you can look at it online. But that is an annual report. And if you want a closer look, another snapshot, you should do a test and send it to a certified lab. And also on my website, I tell you how to find a lab. That's what I did in New York. Everyone knows New York has great water, but the more I learned about...
of course, it comes from the rain. It's actually rainwater.
And snowmelt.
Snowmelt,
yep, up in the Catskills. But I became concerned about disinfection byproducts. I learned that organic material in the reservoirs can mix with chlorine to make these byproducts that have been linked with cancers. And my annual report said the levels were fine, but I learned how these things get averaged out and they can spike. And so I did my own test, and it was extremely reassuring. And I realized I didn't have to invest in another kind of filter.
Are you concerned at all about the fear that some of the chemicals in the bottle leach out into the water if they sit in the bottle too long?
I'm not drinking bottled water, so I don't have to think about it. I mean, I thought about it for the book, and I learned that the PET plastic does not contain phthalates. There's a lot of talk about phthalates. That's a plasticizer, and it's an endocrine disruptor. But it's not in those number one bottles. It is, however, in the number two bottles, which are the one-gallon jugs of water and the 2.5 gallons. So that's number two plastic with phthalates. And there's a chemical in the hard polycarbonate bottles, which I have used for 25 years, the Nalgene type sport bottles. They have a chemical called bisphenol A, also an endocrine disruptor. So Nalgene has changed its formula to avoid the BPA. I haven't thrown out my Nalgenes, but I moved to a metal bottle. So I go back and forth between the two.
All right. Let me get a question in from Dave. Dave in Columbia, South Carolina. Quickly, we've got about a minute left.
Oh, I just want to say I really, when I was in Rome for a while, I used to love drinking water from the public water fountains there. And I don't know if there has been any issues since then about the water quality in Rome. But I was wondering about a correlation between the rise of bottled water and the decline of public water fountains in American cities.
Yeah, I think they're definitely linked. And even if the fountains are still there, I think there's a fear of fountains that is unfounded. I talked to microbiologists about what happens when people drink from them. I'm trying to encourage municipalities to install more fountains and take better care of them. And let's return to the public tap, because this is a zero-waste proposition, and we'll save money and avoid waste if we could drink publicly instead of in little plastic bottles.
California is looking to turn wastewater back into drinking water, is it not?
Yeah, Southern California. They import most of their water. It's really expensive. It takes a ton of energy. And so they're starting to look at their wastewater not as something to get rid of in the ocean, but to run through a gazillion filters, much like Coke and Pepsi, and turn it back into drinking water. I tasted it. It was fantastic. They put it back in the ground after they clean it up, and then utilities suck it out of this aquifer or this groundwater basin.
Yeah, there's too much of a yuck factor still to just put it back in a bottle, I guess.
Yeah, but they don't say bottle. You mean put it back in the tap.
In the tap, that's what I meant, yeah.
They think that, yes, the Department of Health right now wants them to put it in the ground, but people at the groundwater replenishment plant told me that in another 10 or 15 years, we're going to be looking back this time and laughing at ourselves for taking very expensively cleaned good water and putting it in the ground, and we'll be drinking it directly later.
Well, that's a hopeful sign. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Have a happy holiday.
You too.
Elizabeth Reut, author of Bottle Mania, How Water Went on Sale and Why We Bought It. And if you go up to her website, you can get a link to her webpage if you can't find it there. That's about all the time we have today. Our program is produced by Karen Vergoth and senior producer Annette Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman, our producer for digital media. Our interns are Christopher Intagliata and Liz Burns. Josh Rogerson is our technical director, and he's here at the controls in New York. We had help in Second Life from Lynn Cullins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, and the University of Denver. And if you surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, you can get some videos there. There's a new video of the week about that beetle that's eating up the trees in Pennsylvania. Also, you can download it on your iPod or go to iTunes and get it there also. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.